Chapter 24. Vaughn regretted that because Letrocalamity, Van Vitelli's old joke, was banned all over the world, its very name having become a dirty word among upper-upper-class families, in the British and Brazilian sense to which the Veens and Dermanoffs happened to belong, and had been replaced by elaborate surrogates only in those very important utilities, telephones, motors, what else? Well, a number of gadgets for which plain folks hanker with lolling tongues, breathing faster than gun dogs, for it's quite a long sentence. Such trifles as tape recorders, the favorite toys of his and Ada's grandsires, Prince Zemsky had one for every bed of his harem of schoolgirls, were not manufactured anymore, except in Tartary, where they had evolved minaretchki, talking minarets of a secret make. Had our erudite lovers been allowed by common propriety and common law to knock into working order the mysterious box they had once discovered in their magic attic, they might have recorded, so as to replay 8 decades later, Giorgio Van Vitelli's arias, as well as Van Veen's conversations with his sweetheart. Here, for example, is what they might have heard today, with amusement, embarrassment, sorrow, wonder. Narrator. On that summer day, soon after they had entered the kissing phase of their much too premature and in many ways fatal romance, Vaughn and Ada were on their way to the Gun Pavilion, alias Shooting Gallery, where they had located, on its upper stage, a tiny Oriental-style room with bleary glass cases that had once lodged pistols and daggers, judging by the shape of dark imprints on the faded velvet, a pretty and melancholy recess, rather musty with a cushioned window seat and a stuffed Parlugian owl on a side shelf, next to an empty beer bottle left by some dead old gardener, the year of the obsolete brand being 1842. "Don't jingle them," she said. "We are watched by Lucette, whom I'll strangle someday." They walked through a grove and past a grotto. Ada said, "Officially we are maternal cousins, and cousins can marry by special decree if they promise to sterilize their first 5 children. But, moreover, the father-in-law of my mother was the brother of your grandfather, right?"
"That's what I'm told," said Vaughn serenely.
"Not sufficiently distant," she mused. "Or is it?"
"Far enough, fair enough."
"Funny. I saw that verse in small, violet letters before you put it into orange ones. Just 1 second before you spoke. Spoke, smoke. Like the puff preceding a distant cannon shot." "Physically," she continued, "we are more like twins than cousins, and twins or even siblings can't marry, of course, or will be jailed and altered if they persevere."
"Unless," said Vaughn, "they are specially decreed cousins."
Vaughn was already unlocking the door, the green door against which they were to bang so often with boneless fists in their later separate dreams. Another time, on a bicycle ride, with several pauses, along wood trails and country roads, soon after the night of the burning barn, but before they had come across the herbarium in the attic, and found confirmation of something both had forefelt in an obscure, amusing, bodily rather than moral way, Vaughn casually mentioned he was born in Switzerland and had been abroad twice in his boyhood. She had been once, she said. Most summers she spent at Ardis. Most winters in their Kaluga town home, 2 upper stories in the former Zemsky Chertog, Palazzo. In 1880, Vaughn, age 10, had traveled in silver trains with shower baths, accompanied by his father's beautiful secretary, the secretary's 18-year-old white-gloved sister, with a bit part as Vaughn's English governess and milkmaid, and his chaste, angelic Russian tutor, Andrei Andreevich Aksakov, AAA, to gay resorts in Louisiana and Nevada. AAA explained, he remembered, to a Negro lad with whom Vaughn had scrapped, that Pushkin and Dumas had African blood, upon which the lad showed AAA his tongue. A new, interesting trick which Vaughn emulated at the earliest occasion and was slapped by the younger of the Mrs. Fortune,
Put it back in your face, sir, she said. He also recalled hearing a cummerbunded Dutchman in the hotel hall telling another that Van's father, who had just passed, whistling one of his three tunes, was a famous camler. Camel driver? Chameaus having been imported recently? No, gambler. Before his boarding school days started, his father's pretty house in Florentine style between two vacant lots, Five Park Lane in Manhattan, had been Van's winter home. Two giant guards were soon to rise on both sides of it, ready to frog march it away, unless they journeyed abroad. Summers in Rajagaleh, the other artists, were so much colder and duller than those here in this Ada's artists. Once he even spent both winter and summer there. It must have been in 1878. Of course, because that was the first time Ada recalled she had glimpsed him, in his little white sailor suit and blue sailor cap. Un regulier Angelochek, commented Van in the Raduga jargon. He was 8, she was 6. Uncle Dan had unexpectedly expressed the desire to revisit the old estate. At the last moment, Marina had said she'd come too, despite Dan's protests, and had lifted little Ada, hopla, with her hoop, into the caleche. They took, she imagined, the train from Ladoga to Raduga, for she remembered the way the station man with the whistle around his neck went along the platform past the coaches of the stopped local, banging shut door after door, all 6 doors of every carriage, each of which consisted of 6 one-window carrosses of pumpkin origin, fused together. It was, Van suggested, a tower in the mist, as she called any good recollection. And then a conductor walked on the running board of each coach with the train also running and opened doors all over again to give, punch, collect tickets, and lick his thumb, and change money. A hell of a job, but another mauve tower. Did they hire a motor landaulet to Radugaleh? 10 miles, she guessed. 10 versts, said Van. She stood corrected. He was out, he imagined, na progulkia, promenading in the gloomy firwood with Aksakov, his tutor, and Brigroff's grandson, a neighbor's boy, whom he teased and pinched and made horrible fun of. A nice, quiet little fellow who quietly massacred moles and anything else with fur on, probably pathological. However, when they arrived, it became instantly clear that Damon had not expected ladies. He was on the terrace drinking gold wine, sweet whiskey, with an orphan he had adopted, he said, a lovely Irish wild rose in whom Marina at once recognized an impudent scullery maid who had briefly worked at Ardis Hall, and had been ravished by an unknown gentleman, who was now well known. In those days, Uncle Dan wore a monocle in gay dog copy of his cousin, and this he screwed in to view Rose, whom perhaps he had also been promised. Here Van interrupted his interlocutor, telling her to mind her vocabulary. The party was a disaster. The orphan languidly took off her pearl earrings for Marina's appraisal. Grandpa Bagroff hobbled in from a nap in the boudoir and mistook Marina for a grande cocotte, as the enraged lady conjectured later when she had a chance to get at poor Dan. Instead of staying for the night, Marina stalked off and called Ada, who, having been told to play in the garden, was mumbling and numbering in raw flesh red the white trunks of a row of young birches with Rose's purloined lipstick in the preamble to a game she now could not remember. What a pity, said Vaughn. When her mother swept her back straight to Ardis in the same taxi, leaving Dan to his devices and vices, inserted Vaughn, and arriving home at sunrise. But, added Ada, just before being whisked away and deprived of her crayon, tossed out by Marina Ke Chertiam Sobachim, to hell's hounds, and it did remind one of Rose's terrier that had kept trying to hug Dan's leg, the charming glimpse was granted her of tiny Van, with another sweet boy and blonde-bearded, white-bloused Aksakov, walking up to the house, and, oh yes, she had forgotten her hoop. No, it was still in the taxi. But personally, Van had not the slightest recollection of that visit, or indeed of that particular summer, because his father's life, anyway, was a rose garden all the time, and he had been caressed by ungloved, lovely hands more than once himself, which did not interest Ada. Now, what about 1881, when the girls, aged 8, 9, and 5, respectively, had been taken to the Riviera, to Switzerland, to the Italian lakes, with Marina's friend, the theatrical big shot, Grand D. Dumont, the D also stood for Duke, his mother's maiden name, des Oberaux Irlandais, quoi, traveling discreetly on the next Mediterranean Express, or next Simplon, or next Orient, or whatever the other train de luxe carried the three Veens, an English governess, a Russian nurse, and two maids, while a semi-divorced Dan went to some place in equatorial Africa to photograph tigers, which he was surprised not to see, and other notorious wild animals trained to cross the motorist's path, as well as some plump black girls in a traveling agent's gracious home in the wilds of Mozambique. She could not recollect, of course, when she and her sister played note-comparing, much better than Lucette, with such things as itineraries, spectacular flora, fashions, the covered galleries with all sorts of shops, a handsome suntanned man with a black mustache who kept staring at her from his corner in the restaurant of Geneva's Manhattan Palace. But Lucette, though so much younger, remembered heaps of bagatelles, little turrets and little barrels. Biryulki Proshlago. She was, said Lucette, like the girl in Ah, Set Lean, a popular novel, a Macedoine of intuition, stupidity, naivete, and cunning. By the way, she had confessed, Ada had made her confess, that it was, as Vaughn had suspected, the other way around, that when they returned to the damsel in distress, she was all in haste, not freeing herself, but actually trying to tie herself up again after breaking loose and spying on them through the larches. Good Lord, said Vaughn. That explains the angle of the soap. Oh, what did it matter? Who cared? Ada only hoped the poor little thing would be as happy at Ada's age as Ada was now. My love, my love, my love, my love. Vaughn hoped the bicycles parked in the bushes did not show their sparkling metal through the leaves to some passenger on the forest road. After that, they tried to settle whether their ways had merged somewhere or run closely parallel for a bit that year in Europe. In the spring of 1881, Vaughn, aged 11, spent a few months with his Russian tutor and English valet at his grandmother's villa near Nice, while Damon was having a much better time in Cuba than Dan was at Mokuba. In June, Vaughn was taken to Florence and Rome and Capri, where his father turned up for a brief spell. They parted again, Damon sailing back to America, and Vaughn with his tutor going first to Gardone on Lake Garda, where Aksakov reverently pointed out Goethe's and D'Annunzio's marble footprints, and then staying for a while in autumn at a hotel on a mountain slope above Le Mans Lake, where Karamzin and Count Tolstoy had roamed. Did Marina suspect that Vaughn was somewhere in the same general area as she throughout 1881? Probably no. Both girls had scarlet fever in Cannes, while Marina was in Spain with her grandee. After carefully matching memories, Vaughn and Ada concluded that it was not impossible that somewhere along a winding Riviera road they passed each other in rented Victorias that both remembered were green, with green-harnessed horses, or perhaps in two different trains going perhaps the same way. The little girl at the window of one sleeping car looking at the brown sleeper of a parallel train, which gradually diverged toward sparkling stretches of sea that the little boy could see on the other side of the tracks. The contingency was too mild to be romantic, nor did the possibility of their having walked or run past each other on the quay of a Swiss town afford any concrete thrill. But as Vaughn casually directed the searchlight of back thought into that maze of the past where the mirror-lined narrow paths not only took different turns, but used different levels, as a mule-drawn cart passes under the arch of a viaduct along which a motor skims by, he found himself tackling, in still vague and idle fashion, the science that was to obsess his mature years. Problems of space and time. Space versus time. Time-twisted space, space as time, time as space, and space breaking away from time in the final tragic triumph of human cogitation. I am because I die.
But this, exclaimed Ada, is certain. This is reality. This is pure fact. This forest, this moss, your hand, the ladybird on my leg, this cannot be taken away, can it?
It will. It was.
This has all come together, here. No matter how the paths twisted and fooled each other and got fouled up, they inevitably met here.
We must now find our bicycles, said Vaughn. We are lost in another part of the forest.
Oh, let's not return yet, she cried. Oh, wait!
But I want to make sure of our whereabouts and whenabouts, said Vaughn. It is a philosophical need. The day was darkening. A beaming vestige of sunlight lingered in a western strip of the overcast sky. We have all seen the person who, after gaily greeting a friend, crosses the street with that smile still fresh on his face, to be eclipsed by the stare of the stranger who might have missed the cause and mistaken the effect for the bright leer of madness. Having worked out that metaphor, Vaughn and Ada decided it was really time to go home. As they rode through Gamlet, the sight of a Russian traktir gave such a prod to their hunger that they dismounted and entered the dim little tavern. A coachman drinking tea from the saucer, holding it up to his loud lips in his large claw, came straight from a pretzel string of old novels. There was nobody else in the steamy hole save a kerchiefed woman pleading with Ugo Vary Vayushaya, a leg-dangling lad in a red shirt, to get on with his fish soup. She proved to be the traktir keeper and rose, wiping her hands on her apron, to bring Ada, whom she recognized at once, and Vaughn, whom she supposed, not incorrectly, to be the little chatelaine's young man, some small Russian-type hamburgers called bietochki. Each devoured half a dozen of them. Then they retrieved their bikes from under the jasmines to pedal on. They had to light their carbide lamps. They made a last pause before reaching the darkness of Ardis Park. By a kind of lyrical coincidence, they found Marina at Mademoiselle La Riviere having evening tea in the seldom-used Russian-style glassed-in veranda. The novelist, who is now quite restored, but still in flowery negligee, had just finished reading her new story in its first fair copy, to be typed on the morrow, to Tokay-sipping Marina, who had le vin triste and was much affected by the suicide of the gentleman, au cou rouge et puissant de veuf encore plein de sève, who, frightened by his victim's fright, so to speak, had compressed too hard the throat of the little girl he had raped in a moment of gloutonnerie impardonnable. Vaughn drank a glass of milk and suddenly felt such a wave of delicious exhaustion invading his limbs that he thought he'd go straight to bed.
Tant pis, said Ada, reaching voraciously for the keks, English fruitcake.
Hammock? She inquired, but tottering Vaughn shook his head and, having kissed Marina's melancholy hand, retired.
Tant pis, repeated Ada, and with invincible appetite started to smear butter all over the yolk-tinted rough surface and rich incrustations, raisins, angelica, candied cherry, cedrat, of a thick slice of cake. Mademoiselle La Riviere, who was following Ada's movements with awe and disgust, said,
Je rêve. Il n'est pas possible qu'on mette du beurre par-dessus toute cette pâte britannique, masse indigeste et immonde.
Et ce n'est que la première tranche, said Ada.
Do you still want a sprinkle of cinnamon on your lait caillé?
Asked Marina.
You know, Belle, turning to Mademoiselle La Riviere, she used to call it sanded snow when she was a baby.
She was never a baby, said Belle emphatically. She could break the back of her pony before she could walk.
I wonder, asked Marina, how many miles you rode to have our athlete drained so thoroughly?
Only 7, replied Ada with a munch smile.